Well, this is week two of Advent. We got the right number of candles lit. That's good. That's always a good start to the service. And it helps me remember which week we're in. In case you weren't here last week, I mentioned that Steve and I have chosen, as we go through this Advent season, four characters that are part of the Christmas story in some way. And we're trying to look at Christmas through their eyes, understand how they might have experienced the coming of Jesus, and see how maybe gaining their perspective can help us experience Christmas in a new and deep kind of way. Last week, I kicked things off by looking at Christmas from the perspective of the prophet Isaiah. This week, I want to turn to an individual who I consider to be one of the most fascinating characters to ever show up in the Bible, and that is Herod the Great. Now, to be clear, when I say fascinating, I don't mean fascinating in the sense of I want to grow up and be like this guy. I mean sort of fascinating in the sense of watching a train wreck and not being able to take your eyes off it. Now, just to avoid confusion here, there are a lot of Herods who are referred to in the Bible. Either directly or by some kind of allusion, there are upwards of six Herods that appear in the Bible. This Herod, Herod the Great, is the Herod who was alive and ruling when Jesus was born and died shortly after Jesus' birth. So he's not the Herod that will show up later on in your Bibles, just to make sure we're clear on that. As I did last week, I'm going to share this from a first-person perspective. I'm going to try and, as scary as it might be, try and get inside Herod's head and speak as he might if he were here on stage. So here is my take on Christmas from the perspective of Herod the Great. I was born a Jew. Well, I suppose I should nuance that a little bit for you. I was not a Jew by any deep ancestry, but my grandfather was forcibly converted to Judaism by the ruling dynasty of the day, the Hasmoneans. So I still like to think I come by my Jewish roots honestly. My dad, Antipater, displayed fierce loyalty to Rome, and as a reward, he was made the Roman procurator of Judea. Being well-liked by Caesar, Dad put in a good word for me, and by the age of 25, I was made governor of the territory of Galilee, which was the beginning of my illustrious career. Well, there was a little bit of a hiccup early on. The Parthians invaded and took control of the region. I was lucky enough to get out of Dodge on time. I escaped south to Egypt and then took a boat from there to Rome, where, as had been the case with my father, being a loyal company man paid off. Rome, wanting to restabilize the region of Palestine, formally crowned me, by order of the Roman Senate, King of Judea, and sent me back to fight the Parthians and oust them from the country. It wasn't easy. But after 3 years of fighting, I emerged victorious. The culmination of the campaign was the capture of the city of Jerusalem. Maybe you've heard of it. I'll give it to my opponents. They didn't give up easily. And yet eventually my siege of the city was successful, even if it was a little bit messy. Here's how one historian from my day described my triumphal moment in Jerusalem. Have a listen to this. Soon, every quarter was filled with the blood of the slain. The people were slaughtered in heaps, whether crowded together in alleys and houses or seeking refuge in the temple. No pity was shown to infants or the aged, nor were weak women spared. I know it sounds kind of drastic, but the best way to establish your power is to show ruthless strength and make sure your enemies aren't around any longer to cause trouble for you. Which was kind of complicated in my case. I couldn't exactly just do away with all my opponents because my position was a little bit precarious. I was seen by the locals as a usurper to the throne. Now, true, Rome had officially appointed me. I was rightfully in charge. But Rome was a long way away, and many in the region still felt the Hasmoneans were the rightful ruling dynasty. That meant I had to work all the angles and walk a fine line to keep my throne stable. One of my strategies was to create an alliance of sorts with the Hasmoneans. I married a Hasmonean woman, Mariamne, hoping it would buy me some goodwill with the people. She was one of my 9 wives. Or was it 10? I can't exactly remember. Having 9 or 10 wives is kind of complicated. Having 9 or 10 mothers-in-law is kind of complicated too. And Mariamne's mom, Alexandra, she was a special kind of pain in the neck. But I did my best to put up with her because, well, as it turns out, Mariamne was my favorite wife, and it wasn't even close. That's probably the only reason I put up with Alexandra and all her scheming to try to get the Hasmonean dynasty back into power. Now, more about my complicated family situation in just a moment, but first I want to tell you a little bit about myself. Amongst my many accomplishments, maybe what I'm best known for is being a great builder. And not just any old builder, but a builder who took pride in conquering nature, if you will. One of my crowning achievements was the building of a grand city on the coast, which I named Caesarea Maritima. Here's a piece of free advice. It never hurts to name a city after the guy who signs your paycheck. And from what I gather, Caesar Augustus was tickled pink that I called this Caesarea. It probably didn't hurt that I erected a grand temple there as well, dedicated to the goddess Roma and the god king Caesar himself. Now, I know what you're thinking. I said I was a Jew. What am I doing building pagan temples? Well, let's just say it's very helpful to be Jewish when you're around the Jews. But when in Rome, look, it never hurts to know your audience and play to them. One of the geographical challenges in Judea is there's lots of coastline, but almost totally devoid of natural harbors, which makes maritime traffic and trade very difficult. When nature isn't helpful, you just reshape it. So in addition to a magnificent amphitheater and an adjacent hippodrome at Caesarea Maritima, I built a man-made harbor. I imported volcanic sand from the Bay of Naples all the way over in Italy, a substance capable of hardening underwater. This hydraulic concrete mixture was then poured into wooden forms, which I had floated out into the ocean before being set in blocks. Blocks nearly 30 feet wide, 50 feet long, weighing 50 tons. Finally, of course, a palace jutting out into the Mediterranean with 2 indoor swimming pools was my gift to myself for a city well built. Of course, you're a religious crew, so maybe you're more interested in my work at the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Amongst other things, what I wanted to do was double the size of the Temple Mount and attach my name to it. I wanted to extend the Temple Mount to the north, but there was a hill in the way. I simply ordered that the hillside be cut away, and the project went forward. At the south end, the problem was the opposite. The Temple Mount couldn't be extended because it fell away into a valley. So we engineered a series of massive archways, built a platform on top, and voila. The Temple Mount that you would visit today is the one that I'm responsible for. And the stones I used for building, exceptional craftsmanship, if I do say so myself. They were cut so precise that no mortar was used to even fit them together. One of the stones in the wall, which you can gladly go see today if you don't believe me, is 42 feet long and weighs almost 600 metric tons. And fortresses. I love fortresses. They're fun and they're practical, since you never know when you might have to run for the hills because of a little rebellion. Never hurts to have a contingency plan, and there's nothing better than a contingency plan than a number of contingency plans. On the far side of the Dead Sea, I reconstructed Macaris, a palace hideout with amazing views and difficult access for people you didn't want finding you. Sadly, the only thing you probably know about Macaris has nothing to do with me. Years after my time, it would be the place where my beautiful granddaughter, Salome, or great-granddaughter, depending which side of the family you want to follow, would famously dance, and where John the Baptist would be beheaded. Then there was the Herodium. I know. But I had to name something after myself. The Herodium was a backyard fortress, a stone's throw from Jerusalem, a place to make a quick getaway. Once again, I had to do a little bit of landscaping to make this project work. I had a 7-story fortress built on top of a small hill and then brought in gravel and other fill and pushed it up against the outer walls to create the top cone of a mountain, with a fortress now what seemed like inside the mountain's crater. I may not be a mountain mover, but I am a mountain builder. And then Masada, oh Masada. Here, God finally got the topography right. I was simply left to paint on a magnificent canvas. An incredible hilltop surrounded by valleys on all sides on which I built a lavish fortress. The ascent was so narrow and so steep, it was nearly impenetrable. In fact, after my time, 967 Jewish rebels, men, women, and children, would hold out on top of Masada for months and months against between 8,000 and 10,000 well-trained Roman soldiers. Amongst other things, it had 2 palaces, lavishly decorated and furnished, a bathhouse with every amenity you can imagine, massive storerooms for food, a cistern cut into the side of the mountain so large that from one flash flood, it could store enough water to sustain 1,000 people for a year. Did I say one? I had 18 of those. Some people may think my overplanning of fortresses in the region pointed to paranoia, but that's ridiculous. Who needs to be paranoid when you can dot the landscape with fortresses? Earlier, I introduced you to my family. I should probably round that story out a bit because it's a little complicated. The issue of marrying Mariamne and trying to stay connected to the Hasmonean dynasty was a proverbial rock in my shoe, and my mother-in-law was often that rock. For example, at one point, I tried to appease her by making her son, Aristobulus, the high priest, against my better judgment. He wasn't long in the position before I realized how popular he was with the people. He was a Hasmonean, after all. Popular people with power and no loyalty are dangerous to a king. As much as I blame my mother-in-law for the poor suggestion, my life motto is, you make the mess, you clean it up. Which I did by ordering Aristobulus be drowned in my swimming pool at my Jericho palace. Sadly, he was only 17 or 18. But what can a king do? In hindsight, maybe the most tragic was a little situation that came up in relation to a business trip to Rhodes that I took. Before leaving, I put my lovely wife, Mariamne, and her scheming mother under guard, for their safety, of course. Not that I was worried something might happen while I was gone. And then I came back, and I had this sinking feeling something bad still happened. What if, though under guard, what if Mariamne had slept with her guard? I had no proof that anything happened, just this sinking feeling that maybe there had been an affair. So I dealt with my suspicion the only way I knew how. I had my precious Mariamne put to death. It was a decision that haunted me for some time, quite literally. For a while, I would see her places out in the street as though she were alive. People began to question my sanity, if you can believe that. While I was in this state, my mother-in-law made her move and seized control of the Jerusalem garrison. Though I may have been a little bit asleep at the switch to let that happen, I was still with it enough to order yet another execution. By my late Mariamne, I had 5 children, 2 of them sons. Of course, being Mariamne's kids, they were part of the Hasmonean line, which the sons by my other wives weren't, and that made for jealousy and family drama. All the other family members started telling me things, bad things, about these 2 sons of Mariamne. Whether there was any truth to the rumors, I had no idea, but when you're a king, you can't chance this stuff. So I had them executed, this time death by strangling. And did I mention the rumored threat to my throne by my oldest son, by my first wife? No? I'm guessing you have a pretty good idea what I did about it, though. Right? Nothing a good execution can't fix. Seems I gained a bit of a reputation. Apparently, word of my activities even reached the ears of Caesar Augustus, who reportedly said, "It is better to be Herod's pig than his son." And then there's that time when some foreign dignitaries arrived in town without warning. It was a Wednesday, I remember, because word came to me during my weekly lawn bowling game that a caravan of camels was approaching town. I know that word on the street is that when I heard the news of the caravan coming, I was terrified, I was frightened. It's a bit of an exaggeration, if you ask me. I prefer to think that I was appropriately concerned. Dignitaries arriving in town unannounced, especially coming in a formal caravan like that, well, that was unheard of. I asked some of my trusted officials to find out what they were up to. When they reported back, I was stunned by the news. I assumed they'd be here to trade goods or maybe spend a few nights at the Dan Boutique Hotel. But no, they were asking around. Get this. They were asking for where the newborn king of the Jews was. Newborn king of the Jews? I'm the king of Judea. I wasn't dead. Why were people asking about the new king? Someone clearly didn't get their facts right before planning a long trip to Jerusalem. But when I chatted with my advisors about it, they seemed to think these guys were convinced. They said they had come because of an astrological sign. A star had appeared, which they had called his star, and they followed it here to Jerusalem. Again, paranoid I'm not, but I like to be cautious. So I called the leading priests and the teachers of the law to see if this rang a bell with them. If anyone knew, I figured it would be them. They pulled out the scroll and read to me from Micah 5:2, "But you, O Bethlehem Ephrathah, are only a small village among all the people of Judea. Yet a ruler of Israel whose origins are in the distant past will come from you on my behalf." Bethlehem. That was just a stone's throw away from Jerusalem. If this was true, then a potential rival to my throne had been born right under my nose without me knowing a thing. I wasn't about to take any chances, so I invited the delegation to join me at the palace for tea and asked some of the details about when the star appeared, what it meant. I lay it on pretty thick to make sure these guys stayed with me. And then instead of sending them on a wild goose chase, I did exactly the opposite. I told them that Bethlehem was where they should look. Why do your own dirty work in trying to find your next candidate for execution when others are very eager to find him for you? I implored them in a performance that I'm quite proud of, if I do say so myself, that I really wanted to be first in line to worship this new king and that they should send word to me as quickly as possible. It was a brilliant plan. Other than the fact that these so-called wise men turned out not to be men of their word. I haven't seen them since that day. At some point, enough time passed that I realized they would have been long gone and had not made good on their promise to let me know where this king was. So that left me in a pickle. I mean, trust me, I would have preferred that my scalpel-like approach to the problem would have worked. Just take out one child with precision. But sometimes you have to take the shotgun approach. I knew the town the boy was born in, after all. I could work with that. I knew that he could be no older than 2 years of age. So I sent my soldiers to kill all the boys under 24 months of age. And then I left the soldiers there for a few days after they carried out my orders just to keep an eye on things. Grieving families can be a nuisance when you're forced to do something unpopular, even if it is for national security reasons. The only downside to Bethlehem being so close to Jerusalem was that at night, when the wind was still, you could actually hear loud weeping coming from the city, and it kind of ruined my sleep. It was the next day, maybe it was a couple days later, I heard one of the court scribes reading a portion of the scroll of Jeremiah. "A cry is heard in Ramah, deep anguish and bitter weeping. Rachel weeps for her children, refusing to be comforted, for her children are gone." Something about the way he read it made me wonder if he thought somehow my order was a fulfillment of ancient prophecy. Come to think of it, that would be something, wouldn't it? And why not? I mean, I was a pretty big deal, if I do say so myself. It shouldn't be surprising that a divine book would tell something of what I would do. Okay, let me just cut to the chase here for a second. I know what you're thinking. I know what you're thinking. I can see it written all over your face. You sit there all nice and smug, judging me. You think you're so much better than me, do you? You think you're really that much different than I am? Really? Is that really true? And I've watched you long enough. I've seen a thing or two. Seems to me you've built a pretty nice little empire of your own. You've accumulated a bunch of nice stuff along the way. You've got a pretty cozy home. You enjoy your vacations. You've got a nice collection of toys. You like the creature comforts of life. You may not be as big a deal as me. You're not king of Judea. But still, from what I can tell, it looks like you've created your own little kingdom of sorts in your own life. So from one king to another, let's just be honest here. I'm sure that the last thing you want is anyone coming along and messing up your kingdom, the life that you've so carefully crafted and tailored for yourself. You're not really wanting someone to come along and disrupt all that. I mean, you've worked hard for it. And I totally get that. I get that, because you and I, we're not that different. And this child born, this baby, he's a disruptor. Make no mistake about it. He didn't come as a craftsman. He wasn't born as a sheep herder. The wise men didn't say that they were looking for the blacksmith of the Jews. No, he was called King of the Jews. King. And kings, they claim authority. They claim territory. They come to rule. They decide how things should be. You don't give kings orders in life. Kings show up to reorder life. Your life. Make no mistake about it. This birth was not about a cute little baby coming into the world. This was a disruption of the status quo. This was a shaking up of the whole system. Granted, I had my own unique way of trying to make sure this baby couldn't be king. I'm pretty sure none of you have wiped out innocent children in order to keep your kingdom intact or protect your place on the throne. But can you really look me in the eye and tell me that you don't have your own ways of making sure that this baby king doesn't make his way onto the throne of your kingdom? Are you really open to him coming to disrupt everything you've worked hard to build? Your priorities, your goals, your wants, to come and turn it all upside down? Are you really willing to let him remove you from the throne of your life? Or whatever else you have on there, your spouse, your children, your image, your job, your need to please, social media, sports, your bank account? Are you willing for those things to be moved aside to make room for this baby king? What creative ways have you worked out to make sure Jesus stays on the fringes of your kingdom? Maybe keeping him close enough that just so you can keep an eye on him. Give him a few corners of your life to play in. But keep him from getting to the very center. Well, it turns out that this baby boy escaped my clutches, fleeing town with mom and dad to Egypt. And since we had no extradition agreement with the Egyptian province, wasn't much I could do. And now, look how it turned out. I'm Herod the Great. And what I'm most famous for is being a secondary character in a story. And on the flip side, this baby king, this king named Jesus, is still very much alive. And his birthday gets celebrated all over the world every single year, Christmas. He's the story. I'm the footnote. I know. You have plans to celebrate Christmas not too long from now. I don't want to sound bitter or anything. I'm not here to ruin your festivities. But do you know what you're really celebrating? You act as though this is all about what's in it for you. But what about what Christmas asks of you? What will you do with baby Jesus, the King, this Christmas? See, if you actually welcome him, if you actually embrace him, if you actually celebrate him, make no mistake, my friends, he will mess with your kingdom. Whether that's good news or not depends, I suppose, on how tightly you hold to the life you've built or are trying to build. Truth be told, King Jesus doesn't come to be a nice model citizen of your kingdom. He comes to dismantle your kingdom and call you to join his kingdom. So celebrate Christmas if you wish. Don't let me stop you. Just know that your celebration calls you to the biggest choice you'll ever face in life. What king? What king will your life bow down to? So, Father, I thank you for this story in Matthew 2 that we have, that very clearly portrays to us that Jesus comes as King. And I pray that as we go through this Christmas season, that each one of us will wrestle with what that means. God, I invite you now, even in a few moments of silence, Holy Spirit, speak to our hearts. And in a moment of silent reflection, Holy Spirit, would you reveal to us anything that is taking up space on the throne that we need to move aside for Jesus? Would you speak to us about that even now in this moment? God, give us the strength, the courage, the resolve, the clarity we need to walk through life with our knee always bowed to Jesus, King Jesus. It's in his name that I ask this. Amen.